You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
My name is Kavita Patel, and I'm one of the fellows and managing directors here at the Brookings Institution in the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform. We're really glad all of you could join us today, and we've got a packed agenda, so I'm going to keep things short and simple. We have both folks in the room, as well as I wanted to acknowledge a number of people watching via webcast. And because we're video recording the event, I want to make sure we have a couple of items just so you know. We'll have a full recording on our website, on the event page, on the Brookings website in the coming days. And if you do have any questions or comments in the room or on the website, go ahead and actually wait until we have an open floor for questions and answers. So hold time until we actually have a question and answer session. And since we are using a web and TV monitoring, we'll all ask everyone to use a microphone and we'll have mics available during Q&A. We also have the ability to submit questions via Twitter. And you'll see the hashtag for this event is healthdata. You can also tweet at BrookingsMed just in case any of you would rather use different media to get the questions. And if you are viewing online, you can immediately download a couple of resources that I wanted to point you to. And once I finish this housekeeping, we'll get to kind of why we're all here today. But the two items that we have that are also available in the room if you're in person are, one, a first issue brief that's also on the Commonwealth Fund website as well as ours regarding the CMS Medicare physician payment data and the topic we're discussing in part today. And then also something that I want to thank Caitlin Brandt and Domitia Masi, who helped with this effort. Once we had talked to so many of you, we learned that there were so many tools out there around transparency that even to us who talk about this on a daily basis, it became overwhelming. So we decided to just, at least for the sake of today's conversation and hopefully in the spirit of moving forward, put together our own online non-exhaustive resource list. We'd love feedback on this, and we would encourage you to send us feedback through the website or through the Twitter feed so that we can get your real-world take on how valuable some of these resources are. But those are also available through the website and the link below. So with that, I want to just kind of start things off. I'll be moderating the first panel, so I'll do a little bit of a kind of intro and stage setting at that time. But I wanted to actually ask Stu Gutterman, one of the vice presidents of the Commonwealth Fund, to give us some of his thoughts. This work wouldn't have been possible without support from the Commonwealth Fund. And I'll say that the work that they've been doing on transparency and delivery system reform has been instrumental in helping us to get to today and hopefully to get past today into what I hope is healthcare of the future. So, Stu, some comments, and then we'll start. Thank you.
Thanks, Kavita. On behalf of the Commonwealth Fund, I'd like to thank everybody for showing up here and everybody who's watching online. I just have a couple of thoughts to kind of set the stage. We talk about transparency, and lately I find myself asking the question, what does that really mean? Back when we first started talking about transparency, it really kind of caught on, especially in Washington and among policymakers. I got this image that we were really talking about putting the proverbial black box inside a Lucite box and calling that transparency, but nobody could really figure out what was going on. You could just see the outside of the black box better. So what do we mean by real transparency? I think the folks here today will help address that. It's great to have a lot of data, but what we really want is information. That means we need to have data in usable form. We need to have data at the right time, and we need to have it in the right context. That is, it needs to be provided to the folks who can use it the way they need to use it effectively. And we're talking about consumers and about researchers, about payers, and, of course, policymakers. I'm hopeful that the topics we'll be addressing today in these panels will begin to give us some insight as to how we can use all the data available to good use and make better policy and make better decisions, both in what we produce in the healthcare system and what we consume and how we consume it. So I won't hold up the show any longer, but thanks again, and I look forward to the discussions.
All right, with that, let's go ahead and get to our first panel. If I could have Chuck, Charlie, and Niall come up so that we can mic you. And let's have you kind of go, Chuck, if you don't mind. Yeah, the last, we'll kind of go in order. And then Charlie, and then Niall, and then me. Yeah, that way you guys can get mic'd up from... All right, we're just going to wait till it's live. Okay. Oh, good. Perfect. So we have, let me just, for the sake of getting us started, make sure that I get introductions kind of from me to your, going from all the way next to me to all the way to your left. And I'm Kavita Patel, and this is Niall Brennan from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Chief Data Officer, Charlie Orenstein from ProPublica, and last but not least, Dr. Charles Cutler from the American College of Physicians. We have extensive bios for all these esteemed individuals in the packets that are available in person as well as biographies online. So I don't want to spend time reading their bios, but sufficient to say that the goal of this first panel was to really offer perspectives from exactly what started a lot of this, which was the data release that came out earlier this year in 2014 on physician payments. That was actually the motivation of what myself as a physician, who's actually part of the data set, really wanted to explore and understand what does this really mean for patients. And I'll just tell you that we're going to get into some deeper kind of discussion around this topic. This hit home not only from when I looked myself up, which all of you can do online, and Niall can tell you more about how to access that information. But even more importantly, in real patient care, I had a 61-year-old woman who came in with what she thought was a cracked rib after picking up her grandchildren, who were pretty heavy at the time, and she's kind of a small, diminutive woman. And she said, oh, I think I cracked a rib. And I said, that's a little unusual. We got an x-ray. Long story short, over 48 hours, found out that she had what was most likely lung cancer. Not clear how it started or if it was metastatic. But she asked me a very important question. She said, who are the best doctors for me to see? And I actually pointed her to some of Charlie's resources on ProPublica, which he'll share with you. And then I went through the difficult conversation of how so much of American medicine is not transparent. And she said, well, I'll talk to a friend who's a doctor. And ultimately, when really important decisions get made, we cobble together a lot of these resources. And yet, I think all of us in this panel, as well as the future panels today, would tell you that we can do better. So I'm going to leave it at that, and hopefully, through each of our expert panelists, as well as your own discussion, we can get into this a little bit more and probe how what we've started, and I think Niall can speak hopefully a little bit more about what CMS and the administration did, what we've started is really just the beginning. So, Niall, I'm going to ask you first to kind of give us a little bit of background on what's been done, and then also a little bit about what you're hoping the future can hold with regard to data transparency.
Sounds great. Thank you, Kavita. It's great to be here, especially so as I'm an alum of the Engelberg Center.
That's right.
I think I was Aaron McKeeson's research assistant or something like that.
You've gone a long way. So,
so I think how you have to view our various data releases and exercises in transparency is that it's been an ever-evolving journey, really dating back to, you know, 2010 and 2011. One of the first things the president did upon entering office was to sign an executive order on open government. And so Todd Park, as then CTO of HHS, you know, enthusiastically embrace that charge across the entire department, not just the CMS, and worked with folks to identify a whole range of available data that was already being released mm-hmm. and maybe not getting the attention or publicity it deserved, or that could easily be released in a machine-readable format. And I think those first couple of years were an interesting process because the commitment to transparency was definitely there. But some of the resulting data sets, they were good, but I think they left people, you know, wanting more. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of facility level data, machine readable hospital compare data, geographic variation data at the state hospital referral region and county level. And that's not at all to diminish or demean those data releases. I mean, again, the geographic variation data, yes, you had Dartmouth historically releasing data of that sort, but that was the first time that CMS had kind of like, you know, laid the books open and said, okay, when you decompose Medicare spending and utilization at the county level, you know, this is what it looks like, and mm-hmm. this is what it looks like in very granular ways that can actually help people. What are county level trends in readmission rates? What are county level trends in ER visits, imaging use, et cetera, et cetera? And so I think where it started to get interesting, if you will, was about 2.5 years ago when we were, you know, trying to figure out where we could move next with our transparency effort, and the decision was made to release hospital charge data. And again, some folks may remember the release of that data. It mm-hmm. was, you know, for, you know, 3,000 hospitals and the top 100 DRGs. It highlighted massive variation in hospital charges for the same procedure, oftentimes in the same geographic area, and certainly nationally. And, you know, I think it really resonated with people, frankly, I think more than we thought that it would. And, you know, I know that certain health economists, when the release initially happened, well, said, you know, well, nobody pays charges anymore. But to a certain extent, charges are often what people are at least mm-hmm. initially exposed to, particularly if you're not insured or well insured. So I think to a certain extent, the release of that charge data, it was a deliberate step on our part, but the reaction took us a little bit by surprise. And I think it took a lot of people who've been looking at health data and talking about charges and costs, it took them by a little bit of surprise as well. And then, obviously, with the release of hospital data, there was a desire to keep, you know, building on this whole effort. But the issue with releasing physician data was that we were legally prohibited from releasing any data that would allow anybody to identify the total amount of a physician's Medicare reimbursement. That was a legal prohibition that stemmed back to the 1970s. In data geek speak, it's known as the Florida injunction. Mm-hmm. And a little over a year ago, a Florida judge overruled or overturned that injunction, or aspects of that injunction, that allowed us from a policy perspective to begin considering the release of that data. And we tried to do it in as deliberative and transparent a way as possible. We issued an RFI. We asked for public comment, and you know, took all the public comment on board. And then finally in April, I think the open data entered the big data phase, or the quasi-big data phase, with the release of detailed utilization information on almost 900,000 providers and over 9 million records, I think, in the data set. So that's, you know, sort of the story of how we got from there to here. It's been a very interesting journey. I think, you know, we've shown our commitment to this over the past few years, and obviously as a bureaucrat, I can't get into specific prognostications or predictions of what's coming next, but I would say look at our track record over the last 4 years, and I think it's highly unlikely that we wouldn't continue to build on that.
And this was just before we move to Charlie, just to be clear, this had not just been the Florida injunction, but internally there had been discussions prior to even your time in the administration about whether this type
yes.
of data should be released at all. So
yes.
this is not just a couple of years in the making. This sounds like it's been decades.
This was
to try
30-year process.
Right. So a real accomplishment, yeah. but also an acknowledgement. Your newly yeah. your new title as
yes.
Chief Data Officer is a little bit of a nod to the notion that more work needs to be done.
Absolutely.
Is that fair to say? And as part of that, are you increasing capacity within CMS to kind of explore the use of not just these data sets, but kind of the transparency movement as well? Is that part of what you'll be doing now in your new job?
Yeah, I mean, the new role is really, I mean, you can, our little unofficial tagline is maximizing CMS data for internal and external users.
Okay.
And so that manifests itself in a number of different ways, advanced analytics internally, mm-hmm. but also transparency and making data available, whether publicly through,
yes.
files like the physician data release or
mm-hmm.
innovative ways to access more controlled data in a secure manner that respects and maintains patient privacy.
And as part of the work we've been doing, one of the comments and feedback we've received is trying to find ways to help work, whether we call it public or private, partnerships, finding ways to help kind of capitalize on what you've been doing, but also almost crowdsourcing all these different tools and, private sector as well as public sector opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, I'll transition. And Charlie, you've already got the pointer. So if you want to stay there and you can, I know you had some slides, but I wanted to first say that before we even spoke to Charles Ornstein, I think all of us in the room would agree that ProPublica has done one of the best jobs at least trying to offer a way for that 61-year-old patient. When I told her to go to a website, I first pointed her to yours, to be
Thank
perfectly
you.
honest, and I said it's easier to use this website, plus it gives you context for understanding. So I would encourage many of you, we have your website in our resource, and I know you're going to go through some of this, but both as an investigator, a journalist, and I would put you in the category as a researcher as well, because some of the analyses you did really were the first pieces of research on these public data sets. It would be great to hear some of your perspectives, and without all of this just seeming like this is rosy, some of the limitations of what we've seen to date. And I know you're working hard to lead the effort on future transparency releases, both from Medicare as well as from the private sector. So thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Kavita. Yeah, I think that, one of the unfortunate things for NILE is that the more data that comes out there, the more data that you want out there. And
right.
so they open up one door, and then we want to run in and we find seven more that we want to open. So that is one of the challenges here. But I would argue that it's more than just patients that want access to this information. As I've gone and talked to physicians all across the country, one of the things mm-hmm. that I've been really surprised about is how little physicians know about how their own practice of medicine and prescribing of drugs compares to others. They think that they're doing it right. They're sort of benchmarking by word of mouth. But when it actually comes to objectively looking at it, there has been no tools that have been really available. They may get one report card from UnitedHealthcare that says they're doing well, and another report card from Aetna saying they're doing poorly, and one from Blue Cross that says they're in the middle. So they throw all three of them out and then believe what they believe about themselves. So I thought it would be helpful to show sort of the real importance of putting caveats and comparisons two things, because I think that putting out raw data can be very misleading and confusing, and that's one of the pushback on the Part B data release, is that a lot of media organizations, and I don't think it was our best hour, just sort of regurgitated what the government put out and didn't put the context around it, which I think was unfortunate. So even before, well before CMS put out its data on Medicare fee-for-service, the amount that doctors were paid in Medicare, ProPublica thought, well, CMS is limited. They can't release information about how much doctors are paid. But when it comes to prescribing drugs, doctors are merely sort of catalysts. They're not paid for what they prescribe. The pharmacy is paid. So we could get around this prohibition on data release by requesting what doctors prescribed and what the patients filled at the pharmacy. And so after lengthy negotiation, thanks to Niall's advocacy on our behalf, CMS released data about what doctors prescribed in Medicare Part D, which is the prescription drug program. And it looks something like this, which was a lot of rows and a lot of codes and doctors and the drugs they prescribed in numbers. And
Could you just imagine just opening this to patients and saying, okay, take a look? Like, it really doesn't mean very much of anything to them. But why, if you're a patient, would you want access to the information that you're about what your doctor prescribes? Well, one, if your doctor is recommending a drug for you and you want to see, does your doctor have experience prescribing this drug? Because if your doctor doesn't have much experience prescribing the drug, is that the doctor you want to prescribe you this drug? Or conversely, if the doctor has a lot of experience, that may be something that's worthwhile. Two, with the plethora of data out there about financial relationships between doctors and drug companies, having access to, is a doctor prescribing more of a particular drug made by the company for whom he or she is doing speaking, that could be particularly helpful as well. So what we did is we created a tool called Prescriber Checkup, which allowed folks to access things from various portals of entry. And we think this is really important with data, is don't assume you know how somebody wants to access data. People want to access data in a lot of different ways, and you need to give them the tools to do it. So we let you access it by drug to see who the top prescribers of a particular drug are, by state, by specialty, by doctor name. So you can go to our site and look at it through any of these portals to get to results that show you the top prescribers within a specialty, within a state, the top prescribers of a particular medication, or just your doctor prescribing. But instead of just releasing when you click on your doctor to see all of the drugs the doctor prescribes, we also have sort of what we call our dashboard, which shows how similar or dissimilar is your doctor is to other doctors in their specialty and state. And why do we choose their specialty and state? Because we didn't really think it's fair to compare an ophthalmologist to a dermatologist to an oncologist. Each of them are going to have different ways of prescribing, and that if you just release it just in total and let folks, you know, sort of swim their way through it, that could be really confusing. So we show you the percentage of a doctor's patients who get narcotics, but if you're a pain medicine doctor, that's going to bring the whole specialty up. Whereas if you're a family physician, that's going to be a lower percentage base, and how the doctor compares to that. We also have a mathematical formula that takes into account the doctor's selection of drugs and the volume of the drugs they prescribe, sort of bar and puts them on a line of bars where you can see that if a doctor is on the far right, they're practicing in a very different way than other doctors are practicing. And then finally, you can see a list of the doctor's drugs and what it ranks for that doctor, so the doctor's number one drug, and how that ranks for other doctors in the same specialty and state, so that you're able to compare again the doctors. One of the things that we did with the Medicare Part B data, which came out this year, the fee-for-service data, is this is what Medicare released, which is a long list of each of the procedures and what doctors made. And again, the media took this and wrote about Medicare's millionaires and how much money people got from Medicare. That was pretty unfair because some doctors are spending a lot on in-office drugs. They're purchasing the drugs, and then when they're using them again, is it fair to, you know, say that they're millionaires? Well, not necessarily. If they treat a lot of Medicare patients versus somebody who doesn't treat many, is it fair to put them head-to-head? Not necessarily. So what we did is we created a tool called Treatment Tracker, and our tool lets you see this all in context. Again, we compared people within their same specialty and same state. So you could see, for example, the number of services per patient and how that compared. And when you see these red marks, you see that the doctor's in the top 10% of their specialty and state. So again, you're able to see who's a real outlier compared to just who has a big number attached to their name. And we not only gave raw numbers, but we gave adjusted numbers. So the amount paid per service, the amount paid per patient, so that you're able to get a sense of the doctor in comparison to their peers, trying to level out based on their volume of services. And then finally, you're able to see the number of times doctors did things per patient, how much money they got from a particular service, and were that ranked for doctors. And there are definitely outliers. And one of the takeaways that we have from this data and the prescription data is right now, with the information Medicare is putting out, it's a lot easier to find doctors who are off, who seem to have questionable practices, than it is to find doctors who are good, whose practices you want to emulate. Because there's too many variables that we don't know for now, and that's sort of the next stage, is what we want. You know, right now, we have what doctors perform in their office, but if a doctor gives a referral to their pal down the hall, they and the doctor may be incurring a lot of medical costs, and the patient may be incurring a lot of services, but you may not see that on the doctor's profile. So we think the next level of information is information of things that the doctor is the referral for, whether it's DME or lab work or home health or hospice, and you're able to look at a doctor's totality of what they're controlling in terms of healthcare services so that you're able to see the doctor's complete picture in context and, of course, comparing it to others that are like them. So we think there's a huge amount of advances that have taken place just within the past couple of years, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and ultimately this will lead to
patients who are more educated and more engaged in healthcare decisions, but also doctors who are able to benchmark themselves and take the initiative even before a patient asks them how they compare. Thanks.
Charlie, real quick, before we go to Chuck,
yep.
Do you have a sense, given all the work that you've done to date and all the conversations you've had, you started by saying that it might not be patients, you know, they're not the only audience. You mentioned physicians. Who are some of the other people that were really interested in what you've done and kind of your sense of who's using your database right now or the various databases that you have?
I think hospitals are.
Okay.
I think insurers are. I think folks within Medicare are. I mean, we've heard from folks within the organization who think that sort of our interface is a lot easier to use than their own interfaces. So so I think you find a whole lot of folks. And our databases are being accessed a ton of times.
I mean,
we build products that are more than just things that are supposed to be drive-by products that you'll get the first traffic in the first 48 hours of our data release. And we want people to keep coming back. And you're able to go from our page about prescribing and direct link to the doctor's services. So you're able, it's sort of like very easy to navigate around. And as more and more information comes out, that's going to be key, is where people are going to be able to, oh, this is interesting. I want to check this thing about this doctor too. And it's exciting to be a part of that because literally so many different audiences are interested in this information.
And you mentioned a little bit about prescribing behavior and now kind of pharmaceutical relationships. Since we started this work on the Part B data, the physician kind of open payments database has been released.
That's right.
But you already saw the kind of technical problems with trying to do the analyses that you've done already to date on other databases with that one particular one, raising kind of a very common logistical problem for regular folks to access the data as you showed it in its raw form.
Well, that's right. I mean, the assumption that just because the government releases data that it has to be 100% accurate,
right.
That's not necessarily the case. In the case of the open payments data, which is the drug company payments to doctors, they're relying on the drug and device companies to get it right in terms of what they're submitting to the government, which is then what they're releasing. But what we found is that there were situations where the drug companies were spelling the names of their drugs wrong.
Right.
They were listing drugs in multiple columns when they should have only listed them in a single column, but they would duplicate it. They would list drugs as devices and devices as drugs. Mm-hmm. So we've spent months trying to sort this out. It is really complicated and confusing.
Awesome.
And lucky to be at ProPublica to have the resources and the interest among editors to spend the time to get it right rather than face the clock and say we need to get this out in the next 12 hours.
Okay, great. And that's a perfect segue to Dr. Charles Chuck Cutler, who's a practicing internist and also has leadership experience from the American College of Physicians. Just to side comment before you go, Chuck, we actually looked, our staff at Brookings, we looked through dozens of letters that were sent to the Senate Finance Committee when its chairman, Senator Ron Wyden, had asked for public comments from physician groups and physician organizations and anybody on this topic of data kind of transparency writ large. And he was looking at this topic for a number of reasons. And the American College of Physicians, along with a number of other physician organizations, sent very detailed, I think, thoughtful letters that all said, probably just to gloss over similar things, transparency is good, so we know that, but huge caveats around kind of how this data is interpreted by public is something that many physicians, especially given what Charlie had pointed out with some of the media headlines, had really been threatened by. And so I'm going to just kind of speak to that because I had a number of conversations after some of the newspaper and radio and other media headlines went live around, I would say, the outliers spending, you know, kind of reported charges of millions of dollars and trying to understand who these doctors are and why they have millions of dollars of Medicare charges. It made a lot of physicians really nervous about how people would view their own kind of charge patterns within these publicly available data sets. But I thought it raised a very important conversation amongst the physician community where, in the end, everybody kind of remained kind of quietly curious as well as cautiously optimistic that this was the right direction. So, Chuck, your thoughts both as a practicing physician in the data set as well as someone who's been leading some of these efforts at a national level for a physician organization.
Yeah, well, for the audience, the American College of Physicians is the largest medical specialty organization in the country, 141,000 members, internists, medical specialists, and medical students. And I did serve on the board and was chair of the board until last year. In that position, I was able to travel around the country, meet hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors. But my day job is a general internist. I'm in the office. In the morning, I go to the hospital and see patients. And I could share with you, if you took some of my colleagues and put them in a room and said, talk about the data release for 10 minutes, you might have 9 minutes of silence. There are a number of medical issues from electronic health records, the Affordable Care Act, data reporting from CMS on quality parameters, budgetary concerns about CMS and whether or not they'll be able to pay the bills for doctors that I think have a much higher priority among physicians. Now, having said that, data is really important, and this conversation is really important for doctors. And the example you use, Kavita, is perfect. With every patient that I see as a physician, I have to make recommendations, have to help the patient move to the next step. It may be an antibiotic. It may be an X-ray or a procedure. And for my entire career, I have not been able to help patients in the area of cost. It's clear to me the right antibiotic to get you better. But if there are two antibiotics, which is the better one? If both will get you better, which is the more cost-effective antibiotic to use? And you can use that example across every recommendation that physicians make. So what Charlie has begun to put together begins to change that conversation that doctors might have from 9 minutes of silence in a 10-minute period. There may be 15 minutes of conversation in a 10-minute period because it's so important for doctors to know what things cost, and we never have. Now, the other part of that, and I think you've begun to touch on it, is we need outcomes too, because we can't simply make recommendations as a physician to patients simply based on cost, because the cost could be high, but the outcome could be even better than a low-cost procedure. And so the outcome is really important. And the comparisons really need to be adjusted for risk, because if you're a doctor, and I think you alluded to this, Charlie, if you're a doctor that takes care of a lot of sick patients, your costs may be very high, but your outcomes may be very good. So we're in our infancy here, and this is great news for the profession. I think for the American College of Physicians, we are really encouraged by the data release, and we're even more encouraged by honing the data, making it more useful to patients and to physicians. So I think with that, maybe I'll quit.
So Chuck, one follow-up, and then I have a question for all three of you. There were some people that expressed concerns, as I imagine an organization as large as the ACP. You'll hear many sides of this issue. Can you reflect a little bit on what some of the concerns have been from physicians about some of what's been released to date?
Yeah. Well, first of all, and I think it was touched on earlier, accuracy is really important. There is a lot of information out there, and it really has to be accurate information, and physicians, in a sense of fairness, should have access to the data, and if it's inaccurate, there should be a way for physicians to address what they perceive as inaccurate and make it more accurate. The usability is really important, too. We have to be able to access it in an easy fashion. The doctors have to be able to get to it, and the patients have to be able to get to it. And if it's complicated to access the information, it can lose its utility. So some easy mechanism to get to the information is really important. Now, one of the other concerns that the physician community has had, and we've expressed it to CMS, is that one of the deputies alluded to the fact that releasing this data might be a way to address waste, fraud, and abuse. And we can argue about it, but simply because costs are high, we have to be careful not to attribute that that is somehow fraudulent or the high utilizer is wasting services. He or she may be, but simply by having high costs, we have to be careful that there's not guilt by association. So those are some of the things that we were concerned about.
Okay, great. If anyone in the room has any questions, go ahead and raise your hand so we can at least get a mic to you. And then before we get to you, while we get a mic to you, I just wanted to ask if anyone on the panel, and maybe actually Niall, if you can kind of respond. I think that, as you mentioned, you can't talk about future data. You can't talk about any actions that might take place in the future. But in your, can you give us a little bit about, to date, how you've seen what you've done so far on the public side have some influence on the private side? So things that are outside of Medicare or Medicaid, for example.
So, first of all, I think Charlie and Chuck's comments were both excellent and added a lot of, you know, important context. You know, my remarks were a little process-driven, I guess. So in the sense of, you know, we are in our infancy. This is a fluid area. While we tried to make it clear what the data was and what the data was not, mm-hmm. you know, the very nature of the fact that it's open data means that we have very little control mm-hmm. over how people choose to analyze it and present it. So I think in terms of the effect on the private sector, you have many hospital chains and hospital systems undertaking to be more transparent in how their charge masters or charges are displayed. There's legislative activity in several different states seeking to address or formalize the publication or the availability of pricing information. And I think most recently the Healthcare Cost Institute, which is an agglomeration of pretty large national and some regional health plans, announced a pretty large transparency initiative that I think is going to kick off next year, where they're going to look at the data that they have assembled from multiple different health plans. And I don't know if the output is going to be exactly like what we did, but certainly something similar, you know, along those lines, based on everything that I've read. So I do think that our actions have had a trickle down,
kind of a wave of, yeah. All right.
I think Charlie referenced this, but it bears repeating. The commercial payers, by and large, are looking at quality parameters. They're not simply paying doctors fee for service, even if you're in a fee for service environment. But they are insisting that there's quality reporting. But the so-called quality reporting does not take into consideration cost. It's really not high-value care. It is measures that don't consider cost. And I think the next generation of reports that physicians are expected to turn in to the payers will be high-value care. Good outcomes, but at a high value. So,
but I think
this will move it forward.
I think one of the challenges is that, you know, a lot of the health plans are looking at population metrics. But if you're a patient, you care about your metric, right? So, like, it's wonderful that we're measuring, do doctors give quit smoking advice to patients? I'm not a smoker, so I don't, like,
doesn't matter.
It's fine if they don't give it to their smokers. I'm not a smoker, so it doesn't matter to me. So I think what you want to know is, like, I know somebody who's about to have heart valve surgery. They want to know which doctor in their city performs the most heart valve surgeries and how many patients are alive a year after that. And, like, the fact that we cannot answer that for that patient today or tomorrow or even next year, like, that's the question that we want to answer. It's not like, do your diabetics have their A1C under control? Well, I'm a diabetic. I'm not. But if I'm a diabetic and it is under control for me, again, I don't really care if your other patients are. I care about me. So, like, yes, we're a me culture, but we have to make sure that the data releases can be customizable so that the person who's interested in their own health and their own situation can get some answers from it.
But, Charlie, at the same time, patients are complaining all the time about high copays, deductibles. We spend billions of dollars a year in unnecessary care or marginally useful care. And this conversation and this data release gets us closer or gets us away from spending all of those extra dollars that we don't need to spend.
No question.
So I think it does come back to haunt the individual patient. If your copay is going up, your deductible, the cost of your insurance is going up. The reason is we're spending too much money. How can we provide high quality care? We have to factor in cost along with outcomes.
All right. We have a question here. Tell us your name, where you're from, and your question briefly.
Yeah, my name is Li Yang. I live in Maryland. And first, I congratulate you. The transparency of data system is great. But I just wonder, how far can you go? How do you deal with misdiagnosis? Or you didn't even have data from maybe your internal system because the nurse did not give it to you. Or you did not even maintain the complaint system, the information you receive from patients or their relatives. That's very critical, very important. And currently, there's a lack of data about who are the physicians in which hospital, in which area. Even if you check the checkbook or reference USA or government agency, there's no way you can find it. So a lot of physicians, just like a lot of lawyers, they use phony name or false name or paddle name, you know, like Jacob or Jacob, something like that. So exactly how do you really catch the real system, the real information that you should need, like from computer consumers or patient relatives, they submit their complaint. You know, a lot of the nurses, they don't even give the patient the treatment if they ask for it, the record. Just the MVA, they even ask if they don't give it record. And if they do, they give you a fraudulent record. So the fraudulent charges, that type of things. So this type of things is very critical, very essential, and for you to compare the patients and physicians and really professional and fake, because a lot of emergency staff, they ask the wife or the patients to give the liquid, the whole gallon of liquid to the patient so they can perform the procedure. And if you ask any physicians approval, they say no, they don't have it. But
so
if you don't do that,
let me try to wrap this up so that we can get.
I think misdiagnosis.
Misdiagnoses,
patient,
as well
physicians,
as patient,
and by the medical,
all the various reporting of different
system,
information.
Okay. And also procedure that
I got you.
That's just staff. It's not even physicians.
I understand.
And they want to perform
the
procedure.
So this touches on, thank you. So this touches on just a couple of things that I think some of our other panelists might get into, especially our last panel. I think one, we've been settling because a lot of our work started with the physician data set. But as we're hearing, there are so many streams, and you touched on this, Charlie, with wanting to know about the referral network as kind of the next wave of data that could be important to triangulate. What we're really talking about is trying to paint a better picture on the complexity of healthcare services. Do any of you have some comments on, we mentioned hospitals, we've talked about physicians, we've talked a little bit about drugs or devices, other pieces of this puzzle which are much more complicated than what we've touched on.
So I think that to her question, some of the endpoints that involve payments can be measured, right? So when you're talking about physician services and Medicare Part B, you know, that is a payment that is going out the door, right? You're talking about Part D, prescriptions filled, these are at a pharmacy. They log a prescription as being dispensed. Maybe it's not dispensed, but they log it as being dispensed.
Right.
They're being paid for it being dispensed. When you're talking about a referral, there are two different claims that are made. So, but if you're talking about quality metrics, and I'm sure that, Chuck, you can get into this, the quality of electronic medical records, the quality of paper records leave so much to be desired that, like, when you're trying to adjust for things like that, we are
a long way away.
From
and then thinking about different settings. So, obviously, hospitals, physician offices, and then thinking about post-acute and kind of ER settings, intermediate care settings. I mean, the complexity of all of this can be so overwhelming that it could cause you to say, why bother releasing anything? Because we can't do all of it. But it seems like the first was the hospital data, which you talked about. And then, you know, thinking about physician charges because of the Florida case. And then I know that we've also got information, even new to me was the information around dialysis and some of these other services that we do have data released on. Are there other transitional care or care settings that we think we really do need to have better transparency around that, that would be important for patients to have?
Well, you know, not to, well, let me plug the Commonwealth publication on this. And for those who haven't read it.
Unsolicited, exactly.
Now would be the time to look at
right,
it.
Right, exactly.
Because
pull it, out now.
It really addresses this. And I think there's two things that need to be stressed. First, the physician data has to be integrated with the hospital Others. Data, mm-hmm. with the pharmacy data. To look at any of this data in an isolated way, I mean, in a way, it addresses some of what you're bringing up. To do it isolated just doesn't give you the right picture. You have to put it all together. And comparisons are really difficult. But as the Commonwealth publication pointed out, until we get into real detail about outcomes and health status and demographics, we'll never really be able to make good comparisons or the perfect comparison. So hopefully one day we can get there. And we're moving in that direction right now.
All right, I'm going to do a lightning round to ask very quickly, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, what has been released to date? What have you learned from it? Something that, just to give kind of our audience in the room as well as on the website, something that may have surprised you about what has been released to date. And I'll just go ahead and kick it off. I will say that the thing that did surprise me is exactly, I think, what Charlie touched on, that this was actually more important to not my patients necessarily, but I had more physician colleagues and health insurance plan colleagues kind of say, this is really exciting and interesting, and we'd really like to get into that. It's a little bit of a preview of what I think the next panel might speak to, but something that surprised you or something that you learned from this release process.
So I'm a geek, so I just like looking at patterns.
That's good.
generally, so I think in the physician data, just looking at how different services were concentrated or not concentrated in certain specialties. I think the other thing that the thing that surprised me the most actually was how few CPT codes many physicians bill. If you had woken me up in the middle of the night before I started the project and said, like, you know, how many CPT codes are physicians billing? The average primary care physician, I would have said, oh, easy. 50, 60 a year. Maybe more.
Yeah.
And for many, for a significant chunk of physicians, they are billing 10, 15, sometimes even less. I mean, they're some of them are really cranking through those CPT codes,
right.
But like they're specialists. I mean, so that was the biggest surprise to me.
Perfect. All right.
I mean, I had grown up as a health reporter, learning about differences between hospital referral regions and how important hospital referral regions are. I think what I learned through here is just how much variation there is within those hospital referral regions and how, you know, you can literally go one street over and the quality of doctors as measured by services they use, the drugs they prescribe, are so vastly different, and that it really makes a difference to look up an individual doctor.
Great. Chuck?
So I looked up my data. And I thought you were paying me more. I think it's accurate.
Well, I had to take a cut off the top.
Exactly. That's Niall's new job. You get a cut off the top, right.
So I would compliment CMS because I think you got it right in my case. But I've been doing this for more than 30 years, and it was really hard for me, despite all of that experience, to make any sense of it. I began to imagine, well, what are patients thinking? How do they figure out what's going on here?
All right, well, join me. That's a perfect segue to some of our future conversations. Join me in thanking our panel. And we've got, let's do this. We'll have you all, Mike, and then if I can ask our second panel to come to the stage.
And I'll ask, I'm going to have Paul Ginsberg, Dr. Paul Ginsberg from the USC Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics, who also has an extensive background in bio that I'm not going to read, as well as a number of publications related to research in this area. He's going to be leading our second panel. Oh, let me make sure I don't get in everybody's way here. And then also take off. And I'll have Paul, let me have you, yep, oh good, Paul. Paul didn't need to use the stairs, so I'll have Paul sit down and then we'll re-mic. Let's see if we can swap out some glasses for you guys. And Paul's going to be leading a discussion on implications and perspectives from researchers, policymakers, and payers, and we've teed up a number of these issues in our first discussion, but I think we'll have a robust one with the second panel. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we can start now, and I'm really pleased to be moderating this panel. I think Stu Gutterman at the very beginning of the conference set the tone that this is about transparency, and this has been a long-time interest of mine, and I've always believed that some of the confusion about transparency comes from the fact that we talk about transparency because of its aspect of sunshine. We believe particularly public institutions, but other institutions, their operations ought to be more transparent. But we also talk about transparency in terms of it being useful to different types of entities. We first think of patients, consumers, but then when we think a little further, we think about physicians, hospitals, health plans, researchers, and policymakers. And this panel is really about what the three different audiences can do with this information. And we're going to begin with Chapin White, who is a very distinguished researcher, talking about what this means for researchers. Then we're going to hear from Lou Sandy, who's executive with United Health Group, talking about what this release and other data can mean for health plans and also employers who are their clients, and some of them do it themselves. And then we're going to hear from Bruce Steinwald with a long policy background, just to speak from the perspective of policymakers, what can they learn from this information that will help them in their work of making policy down the road. There are two contexts I'd like to ask the speakers to think about. One is that we're going to talk concretely about the April data release that Niall Brennan was describing to us, but we're not going to dwell so much on what was in the April release, but also to talk about what could be in future releases. And whereas Niall could not speak about what would be in the next releases, these panelists can talk about what they'd like to see in the next releases to make it more useful. The other context is that these releases are not the only game in town. You know, with Chapin as a researcher, he can go through the process of paying a lot of money and taking a lot of time to negotiate a data use agreement with CMS and get some of the data that's really raw behind this release. Lou, with United Healthcare, can either work with a qualified entity or apply to become one, and also has another channel. So this is all part of the context. I'm going to stop my talking and turn to Chapin.
Thank you, Paul. It's really terrific to be speaking with you all today. And I think the first question I want to get into is whether this data release of the physician charge and payment data is a big deal. And so, again, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a researcher. When these data came out, we had a couple conversations at RAND. We're kind of salivating over this new data source. What can we use it for? What questions can we look at? And gradually we figured out, well, if there's there isn't really much new we could do as researchers with these data. Any real research questions we would want to get into, we'd really want to use the more detailed micro-level claims data that we would buy from CMS that we do all the time. So does that mean that this data release is not a big deal? No, not at all. I think this data release is really important and is a step forward. And why is it important? Number one, I think that the release of this data has laid down a marker. CMS is saying that physicians' right to privacy does not outweigh our right as the public to know what Medicare is spending and what Medicare is buying. For decades, as Niall mentioned this, there was an injunction in place that prevented CMS from reporting what individual physicians were being paid by Medicare. And by releasing this data, CMS has said that balance between physicians' right to privacy and the public's right to know what's going on in the Medicare program, it's now officially tipped in the direction of the public's right to know what's going on in the Medicare program. The other thing that is important about CMS's release of these data is they've laid down a marker and said, we can release data for specific physicians and CPT codes without running afoul of HIPAA. And if you do research, HIPAA is a vast barrier reef that you have to learn to navigate. And CMS has charted a course. Others can follow it now. So that's the first important thing about this data release. The second is that these data by themselves aren't informative or telling, but data becomes useful when it's put in combination with other data. As CMS releases more of these data over time, we'll start to see trends. Now that we have the physician-level data, we can combine it with the hospital-level data for specific geographic regions and get a fuller picture of what's going on. As other data sources become available, identifying physicians by NPI or National Provider Identifier, we can start combining this CMS data release with those other NPI-level data. At some point, the private sector health plans will begin releasing data. If those data are released in a format that's compatible with the data CMS is releasing, all of a sudden you've got a much fuller, richer, three-dimensional picture of what's going on in the healthcare sector. The other last point I would make is that this data release is a small step, but it's a step in the direction of building our data infrastructure to understand where we are and what's going on in the world and to help us make better policy choices as a society. And I think the one thing that we forget is that our data infrastructure has been built through conscious, sustained effort. And concepts like gross domestic product, we take that for granted. We track how it's going up and down over time. It's growing by such and such percent. The concept of gross domestic product was defined, and the tools for measuring it have been honed over decades, and we devote significant resources to tracking that. That's a tool that's for the use of businesses, government, individuals, and so on. It's a collective data resource that has been built through effort, and I think that is an incredibly valuable effort. I think the CMS data release is one piece in that valuable effort. In terms of where we're going next, what I would be interested to see, the private sector is kind of the black box. Medicare is starting to lay all of its cards on the table. But in terms of prices, practice patterns, geographic variation in the private sector, it's more challenging to get a handle on that. To the extent that we can get private sector data releases that are structured in the same format as the CMS Medicare data releases, then we can start comparing prices, we can start comparing practice patterns, identifying geographic variation patterns in both of those sectors. That to me would be the most fruitful, but probably also the most difficult avenue to go. I'll leave it at that.
Chapin, one question for you. You mentioned at the beginning that the data use agreements and paying CMS for access is, you know, probably better serves many of researchers' needs.
Any thoughts about how that process could be streamlined, be made more efficient as an aspect of a transparency initiative?
Well, the data could be made cheaper. We pay taxes for a reason. We pay taxes so that the federal government can provide services that shouldn't have a high marginal price attached to them. Data is one of the things that I think should be made freely available, even though it takes a lot of resources to produce that data. Once you've made one copy of the Medicare claims data file, it's trivial to generate 1,000 versions of that, 1,000 copies of that digitally. So the price could be made lower. The turnaround time could be reduced. That's a significant problem. HIPAA, you can't. That's just a fact of nature at this point. You have to satisfy all the privacy constraints. But the turnaround time and the price, I think, are barriers to research that could be lowered.
Thanks, Chapin. Lou.
Well, thanks, thanks, Paul, and I appreciate the chance to be here. Appreciate
Engelberg hosting this. I appreciate Stu and the Commonwealth Fund for sponsoring this. I think what I wanted to do was talk about kind of what I see as useful in this release, what are some of the issues and limitations, and then some of the suggestions, to your point, Paul, about where do we go from here. First thing I do want to say is I really want to commend CMS for their efforts to promote transparency in the use of these data. It's refreshing, and it's incredibly important. And it will evolve, this idea of development and evolution over time, and I think is an important theme of this event. Even in this current release, there is some utility in this information, and we've heard a little bit about this today already. I think it's useful in raising awareness of variation, the pervasiveness of variation that we see out of the data. Useful in understanding some of the factors in that variation. Useful, frankly, it's so obvious, it just, Dr. Cutler mentioned this, just useful in bringing transparency around what things cost, just the basic information there. And I think claims data provide what I call a coarse-grained view of clinical phenomena. It's useful for some things, not so useful for other things, but it has some useful dimensions around volume, around the service mix. I'm not in practice anymore. I'm a general internist, but I looked up some of my friends to kind of see what kind of their practice patterns looked like. Particularly interesting for those that you would expect a great deal of information because their practice would be heavily concentrated in a senior population. So I think that it's important. It'll evolve over time, and it can provide some useful insights even in its current somewhat limited form. Now, what are the issues and limitations? I think probably the most fundamental one is that I think health plans have learned over the years that looking at raw claims data is really more an exercise in hypothesis generation than it is in making a determination about much of anything. That you can't just look at a raw data table and say, aha, there's an outlier, let's, do something. It's really more a hypothesis that you actually have to triangulate around, look at multiple data sources, look at trends over time, and then have a further exploration. Particularly, it may involve, and this is something health plans do regularly, having a conversation with that physician to see, you might find an outlier that statistically is an outlier, but they actually are a referral practice and have a unique set of services that they're the only ones who provide that in a region, as an example. So I think that hypothesis generation is the way we should think about the use of raw claims data. The second thing is that, as I said, a lot can be done with claims data, but it requires analysis. I think a theme for all of us will say that it's not just putting the raw data out there. Starting with some simple analysis, some simple descriptive statistics can be very useful. Percentile rankings, such as we heard from ProPublica, standard deviations. And then there are even more sophisticated uses of claims data through the use of technology subjects, episode groupers, and the ability to do case mix and risk adjustment. So I think there's quite a bit that can be done with claims data, even with some of its limitations. And I think it's an interesting policy question about how much the sponsor does, in this case CMS, versus having a raw data file come out and having third parties do that kind of analysis. That's an interesting question. And I think in terms of physicians or any stakeholder, I think probably the most important attribute of this kind of data is the ability to make comparisons. And to do that, you really have to have credible data. Dr. Cutler mentioned that physicians want to compare themselves naturally against other physicians in the same specialty. That would be logical. And I think that's another thing that health plans have learned over the years. And that relates to my third suggestion or limitation, is that what we have learned over the years is, particularly when releasing data around physicians, it's a good idea to run what I would call a service bureau function, the ability to actually serve the stakeholders and in the case of physicians, to answer their questions about the data, to be able for them to look at it and correct it if there are some errors in it. The physicians are very data hungry. They're interested in data if they view it as credible, but they want the ability to do what's called drill down, to drill into the data in ways that make sense to them. All of this is what I would call a service bureau function, and the kinds of things that UnitedHealthcare has done, such as in our premium designation program we've done since 2005. We have a physician portal that has HEDIS data on it that is open to all physicians in our network. This service bureau function is an important suggestion, I think, of how to enhance things going forward. Lastly, let me make a few suggestions for where I think this could go from here. I think I've said some of these already. I think first is to just clean up the data and offer some simple descriptive statistics for all the stakeholders. I think that is a reasonable thing for the sponsor to do, even as others can do other kinds of analysis. Second, I agree with your point, Chapin, the ability to combine data and data sources and data sets to get an important view. In this particular case, it's really quite a limitation that you can't get the full picture of what the physician is doing in Medicare. We have found in the commercial private sector that we might find a physician expending a great deal of resources in the office, but if you look at a total cost of care or an episode basis, they're actually quite efficient. And the reason is that that's their practice style. You won't see that without the ability to integrate and combine disparate data sources. And you know, and it was already mentioned, the Healthcare Cost Institute, that's why we thought it was so important to contribute data to the Healthcare Cost Institute as a multi-payer effort to bring transparency to the private sector market. And that's an interesting example in a couple of levels, because it originally started as an effort really to just be a tracker of private sector cost trend data and utilization data. But as was mentioned, once the parties got together and HCCI was organized and payers started putting the data in, the HCCI said, you know, we could actually use this for transparency purposes. We could actually start to look at quality data in addition to just cost data. So as some of you may know, that's an effort that has been announced and will be deployed in 2015. So to sum up, and the other thing is the HCCI is a Medicare qualified entity, so that's a good example of integration between the public and private sector from a different Medicare program as well. So to sum up, I think there's a lot of opportunity. I think this is the beginning of a new era. Transparency is the coin of the realm. The current release has been useful in some respects and limited in others, but I think it will evolve and strengthen over time, particularly if it moves along some of the directions that have been suggested already.
Thank you, Lou. There's one point you made that got me thinking. You were talking about, one of the steps forward is to go from really raw, unanalyzed data to, at various levels, analyzed data. And at the same time as this is evolving, of course, we're on track to have physician value modifiers in Medicare, which will be presumably fairly analyzed data. I don't know what the transparency plans are, but presuming there are transparency plans, any thoughts about these two different tracks things are moving on?
Well, I think, again, whenever there are multiple initiatives going on, it's always an interesting challenge for any organization to sync them up. But I think, That's why it's a great opportunity for someone like Niall to have a broader view of all the data resources, and as he mentioned, to use them both internally and externally. But I think in general, the idea of moving, I think probably the most important thing is moving beyond, fairly rapidly, beyond just a raw claims release into analyzed data that is consistent in its thematic direction. The measures might be slightly different, but as long as they're sort of, well, this is the domain, I think most people view a best practice, for example, is not just to release cost data without quality data, to combine those, and I think having so that any user can look at a picture that integrates both quality information, to the extent one can have it, with cost data would be useful. So that's a partial answer, I guess.
Excellent. Bruce.
So my job, thank you, Paul, is to take a broader policy perspective and with some particular attention to the U.S. Congress and how they might benefit from this data release and subsequent data releases. And I'd like to start as well by keying off of Stu Gutterman's analogy of the black box inside of the Lucite box. You know, it's easy for us policy analysts to value transparency because we're the lookers, you know, and we want to see more. But it's the lookees, the residents of that black box, who I think need to accept and even embrace the concept of transparency if we're ever going to really achieve it. And so physicians and other providers need to get used to the idea of having their performance evaluated. And as Dr. Cutler has suggested to us, their willingness to do that is partially dependent on how accurate and useful the data are that are being released and how they'll be utilized over time. You asked, Paul, for some suggestions of what we would like to see. I actually have some predictions about what we will see. Now, Niall has not been able to say that they are going to release more data. I'm going to predict that they will. And in fact, I'm going to predict that CMS and its contractors will correct a number of the errors that the media organizations have pointed out, missing data, poor specialty designations, other things of that nature. I think providers may well contribute to that effort. I think they have an incentive knowing that their information is going to be individually available to a wide range of lookers. They have an incentive now to make sure that their specialty is accurately recorded. They have an incentive to match up the national physician identifiers with the billing codes. And I hope that we'll actually have more different kinds of providers available for analysis in the future. But most importantly, as soon as we get that second data release, we have the beginning of what, Chapin? A time series, right? And that's every economist wants to have a time series. I'll give you an example of how that could be useful. The Government Accountability Office, GAO, where I worked for several years, took 2005 and 2006 data, exactly the same database, in essence, that CMS released in April, and attempted to identify beneficiaries who are high utilizers of services given their health status. The correction for health status, as everyone knows, is not perfect, but we were able to identify a group of beneficiaries that were high utilizers. And then we examined those same beneficiaries in a subsequent year. Did they remain being high utilizers? They had a tendency to remain high utilizers, a tendency, a slight one. We then arrayed those same beneficiaries among the doctors who treated them and identified the doctors as high utilizers given their mix of patients, health status, and how many resources they consume. And then we looked at the doctors the following year. They were twice as likely to remain high utilizers as their patients were. And I'd be glad to give you a reference to that work, and I can't go into all the details. There's only certain specialties and certain geographic locations, but it's the kind of thing that one can do with time series data that one can't do with a cross-section. I worked for congressional support agencies for about 12 years. At GAO, I supervised the preparation of roughly 50 testimonies and reports to the Congress. Different congressional committees of jurisdiction over Medicare and other health care spending. In case you're wondering, What do members of Congress spend more time reading, GAO reports or newspapers and news summaries? Anyone care to guess? And by the way, if you ask the same question about congressional staff, you get the same answer. So I look at these news organizations' reports and analyses of the data that CMS released as another potentially important source of information. Maybe it's not in depth. Maybe there are mistakes being made. But I think it's especially useful when you consider that Congress obtains much of its information from companies and organizations, many of them of whom are constituents, that have a vested interest in healthcare spending. And I remind you of the five top DC lobbies in spending, four of them are healthcare, and the fifth is AARP. So to have another information source with a different incentive for producing information is useful. In fact, I would say that these news organizations' publications are complements to, not substitutes, for the kinds of research that congressional support agencies do, like GAO and MedPAC and CBO and other organizations like RAND under contract with CMS. These are complements, not substitutes. I also would expect that because these news organizations will produce information to the Congress and give them ideas on what could be investigated in greater depth, there might be some benefit to the congressional support agencies to be asked questions that were raised by these news organizations to be investigated in greater depth by the organizations that have the resources and the capabilities of doing it. So my bottom line is that this is not only a good thing, it's a necessary thing. It will produce more meaningful information as time goes on. We all believe that transparency is an integral part of healthcare reform, and I look forward to the day, as others have alluded to, where our database is not just CMS production on Medicare, because after all, in Medicare, the entire story is utilization. Because prices are fairly constant except for geographic costs of business differences. You get into the private sector, you see a huge amount of variation. So not only would you have the advantage of being able to combine across different payers to get a fuller picture of what individual providers are doing, to get the private sector data into that mix, and you'll have a lot more opportunity to investigate very meaningful differences in how services are performed around the country.
Thanks, Bruce. You said something very interesting about how some of the media that was based on this release made its way to members of Congress and staffs and likely shaped what they were asking congressional support agencies to look at or even talking about policy-wise, legislative-wise. Mm-hmm. Do you have some sense about interesting directions that this release has spawned?
Was that the only interesting thing I said? I'm
sorry. It's the most interesting thing.
Okay. I don't really know. I mean, this comes under the heading of hope for. I did look up and saw that The Hill, which is a publication for members of Congress, did pick up a number of these stories and reproduce them in their own media. But I can't cite a specific instance of where an issue was suggested to a member who then requested some work of GAO or any other support agency.
Sure, that's fine. Well, maybe in the course of conversation, others will have ideas about that. Okay. Probably a good time to turn to the audience. Yeah, we've got time. Yes, there. Well, why don't you wait for a microphone?
It's Malcolm Lovell of Brookings Advisory Council. Doctors, I don't think today are required to post online what they charge. And I was wondering what you would think of that. It's one of the few services that are important, that you do not have the market visibility that you have in other areas. Do you think we should change that?
Yeah, well, this presumably is not a Medicare issue, because in Medicare, physician, I guess they're very limited, constrained about what they can charge in Medicare. And, of course, those prices coming. So I guess it's more of a question about private insurance. I don't know if you want to take that, Lou?
I think question reflects, again, the desire to have greater and greater transparency on all aspects of healthcare, including what providers charge. Two things. First, even though there's no national requirement, I know at least in Massachusetts, anyone here from Massachusetts, there is a new law that requires exactly what you suggest, which is the posting of prices. So that'll be an interesting experiment to see what impact that has in that state. There may be other states. I'm just not aware of it. I think the other thing is, from the consumer point of view, and we'll hear from the consumer panel after us, I think what consumers want to know isn't so. Our experience has been that what consumers want to know is not what the provider charges so much as what do I have to pay, which then relates to what is the charge in relationship to the benefit package that I have, the network that I have, and, you know, what does it mean to me?
And perhaps so, even a whole episode of care.
Exactly. And sort of if I'm choosing option A versus B, that's a care pathway which will have multiple services in it. So it'll be interesting to see. That information is increasingly becoming available, again, in the same transparency theme that we're in.
Yeah, I think gentleman there had a question.
Thank you, Dave Rabinowitz. I was wondering about the difference between the raw data you have to pay for and the data that's been released. Is it primarily a question of consolidation, so you download less data to answer the same questions? Is it primarily HIPAA? Is it some combination?
If you go through the process of entering into a data use agreement with CMS, you guarantee that you're going to satisfy all of the data security safeguards that they require, which are serious. They will send you claims data that has a beneficiary ID, that has all of the age, sex, zip code of residence of the beneficiary, that has the micro level services. The CMS physician public release only reports combinations of physicians and CPT codes with 11 or more services provided. Obviously, if you buy the micro level data, you can see all the services. But it's a major hurdle to set up data security systems that are impenetrable and that are HIPAA compliant.
Yeah, and also provides the opportunity to pull together the various services from different providers that a beneficiary has had.
And you have to promise not to release anything that violates HIPAA.
A question back there.
David Intricasso, National Associate of ACOs. If the genie's now out of the bottle, from your perspectives, what would be best next relative to CMS data release?
I can, Paul Ginsberg actually mentioned the physician value-based payment modifier, and I'd be curious, how many people, if I say value-based payment modifier, know what I'm talking about? Some? Okay, a lot. Great. So if I had a wish list, it would be that the raw data and the final output of the physician value-based payment modifier calculations be made available at the physician level. I don't know if that's realistic, but that would be... That would be taking this raw data dump that CMS has just made and doing the analysis that a lot of the other presenters have been talking about. The idea behind the physician value-based payment modifier is that Medicare is going to be measuring quality and is going to be measuring efficiency, including all of the services that physicians order, not just the ones that they provide themselves. So I think that would be a significant step forward. I doubt it's going to happen.
Yeah, Bruce?
Well, I think a second cross-section, as I mentioned, would be very useful, but it would be especially useful if CMS could correct the errors in the first release so that when they issue the second release, the first release is more accurate, and therefore you can make better comparisons over time.
Yeah, I think a theme a number of us have talked about is more comprehensiveness and more linkages of the data, for example, Part A and other data sources so that you can have a more comprehensive view either of an attributed population or of a 360 view of what a physician is doing for the seniors that he or she is treating.
Yes, actually, if I can add one thing, this would be even more advanced, would be grouping data into episodes of care to look at how a physician handles, say, a joint replacement or some other, you know, well-defined episode of care, to really be able to compare them to others. Yes, sir.
I am Frank with the Brookings Institution. My question deals with what this might mean for the health exchanges, particularly for each of your constituency groups, you know, policymakers, researchers, and payers. You know, even though this data is only Medicare, what might be some interesting future developments we might see with the health exchanges with more CMS data releases?
It's a tough one. I think that only in a general way. I mean, if you can learn things about, let's say, drug prescribing patterns that is has general utility, then the exchanges might be able to use information of that nature. But since they're not generally treating Medicare patients, I think that there's a limitation in what they can
do. Yeah, I would echo that. We've learned, and we have, I didn't mention this in my comments, but since we provide services to Medicare beneficiaries, UnitedHealthcare does through the Medicare Advantage program as well as MedSup and Part D, we actually have data ourselves on the Medicare population. We have found, we originally thought we could actually combine all those data with the data we have from the commercial marketplace so that we'd have larger sample size, but we actually have found that these are different populations. That it's pretty obvious, but the commercial population, the working age population, is different than the senior population. So when we do quality measurement and reporting, for example, we use different benchmark levels of performance between the Medicare and commercial populations. I think that's my guess is the same phenomenon would happen in the exchange population because that'll be a different population, and particularly it will be evolving over time.
Any questions? Oh, there's one back there.
Hi, Rachel Hornstein. I work in data policy at the Department of Health and Human Services. I had a quick question about last year, the Office of Management and Budget released the M1313 memo on the Open Data Initiative. And one of the concerns in there was a concern of the mosaic effect, how when you release different data sets and you start to link them, there's a possibility of releasing personal identifiable information on beneficiaries or on clients. So can you please touch on that?
I don't have anything to say.
Yeah, so this brings up the Elvis's doctor problem, which is if you report physician-level data and don't have a minimum number of procedures or patients treated, and if you report on the practice patterns of Elvis's doctor and everybody knows who that doctor is, then you can find out everything else about Elvis. So that's the motivation for the 11-plus minimum claim requirement. There's obviously a risk that that really sophisticated data analysts are going to be able to take this data release and combine it conceivably with other data sources and figure out things about individuals. My guess is that there's probably a bigger risk from hackers just getting into the CMS mainframe, but I don't really know. But I think that we're definitely in an area of risks and trade-offs, and there is a benefit to these data being made available. There are increased risks, and the more data sources are made available in greater granularity, the more risk there is of people being able to combine things in novel ways and kind of undo the privacy protections. And I guess just as a researcher, I would just say, let's keep in mind the benefit of these data being made available, and not to just go with always the safest approach.
Yeah, I think the principle of the greater good does apply here. And in fact, even on the data releases, there will always be some errors, and there will always be some misinterpretations of the data, and there will always be a physician who's unfairly singled out as behaving poorly when in fact that person hasn't. But as Japan says, you have to look at those are the costs, but you have to weigh the benefits against those costs. And I think we're of a mind that the benefits far exceed them. Certainly privacy is one of the risks as well.
And, you know, we use our credit cards all the time, even though our credit card numbers are for sale, you know, through underworld hacker websites. So our financial system is constantly balancing the benefits of electronic data exchanges against the risks of, malicious hacker activity. And I think we're gradually groping our way towards some similar kind of balance with healthcare data.
Well, I think it's time to thank the panel for the really good job they did on this topic. I guess we'll execute the same thing where I'll transfer this to Dr. Alice Rivlin, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who will be moderating the final session.
Okay, are we live now? I think we are. Now we're going to shift the focus. We've talked about this data release and several other data releases, and we've talked from the point of view of researchers and health plans and the policy community. But what it's all about is patients and consumers. So now we are going to shift the focus to the patient, the consumer, and talk about what they need to know. And I hope we can be a bit more visionary and expansive in this panel because we are where we are, but where do we want to be? And I hope that these three representatives who've worked very hard on behalf of consumers over quite a long time can help us think about what do consumers really need? What do they need it for? And how can that data be generated? To help us with this question, we have first Robert Krugoff, who is the president of the Center for the Study of Services / Consumer Checkbook. And we have Robert Restuccia, who is the executive director of Community Catalyst, a consumer advocacy organization. And we have Doris Peter, director of Consumer Reports Health Ratings Center, part of the organization Consumer Reports. And I think Doris's organization and Robert Krugoff's rate lots of things, not just healthcare. That's where you go if you want to know about cars or toasters or plumbers or whatever. Now we're talking about healthcare and the a really important aspect of so many people's lives. So we'll start with Robert Krugoff. Tell us a bit about what you think consumers need and what they might need in the future.
Okay. Well, I think first of all, I appreciate being here. And I believe our priority should be to have good raw data readily accessible. If the government can do that, that's an amazing, wonderful achievement. And fortunately, I think the government has recognized that this is important. It has made significant progress. I'm very happy about Niall's recent appointment and love the principle stated in the press release announcing his appointment, citing the government's commitment to frameworks promoting appropriate external access to and use of data, whether in aggregate or granular form. That's what I think should be the government's role here. Unfortunately, there's still a lot to be there are good things that have happened, and there's a lot to be done. I'll give you examples of the good and the bad that I've seen in the government's making data available over the years, and you know, just sort of always gives me some anxiety that things might not go so well the next step around. In 2006, there was HHS's denial of consumers' checkbooks requests that we get physician-identified claims so we could give consumers some information on the amount of experience each physician had with various high-risk procedures. And the government siding with the AMA in an appeal after we won in the lower court. That was disappointing. There was CMS's interpretation of the ACA provision on release of claims data that was much more restrictive than it had to be. The CMS rules required anyone who wanted the Medicare data in order to do performance measures nationally to have matching non-Medicare data in every region. That's an enormous practical obstacle, and it wouldn't have had to be interpreted that way. On the other hand, there was the great news this past April. The government's release destroyed the physician privacy argument against release. So that was an enormous accomplishment, I think. And then that was followed by CMS's quick action to get physician identifiers in the large data files that we and others have been using for years to evaluate hospital death rates and complication rates. Getting those identifiers right in there quickly was just exactly what needed to be done. And CMS recently created the Virtual Data Center program to make use of those files more financially accessible by allowing them to be used remotely. Still more expensive than I wish, at $40,000 annually for a single person to use, although cheaper than trying to get those Part B files straight up, which would be in the $100,000 or more range, and quite unfortunate to cost that much. But there was some bad news when we were told last summer that this virtual research data center system could not be used to produce quality measures on doctors. Couldn't quite figure that one out. So the door sometimes swings open, sometimes closes, but I think we all need to support those at CMS working for openness, often in the face of strong provider opposition. As I say, I believe the focus should be on making raw data available. I'm not optimistic that the government should be itself the producer and reporter of performance measures. But it should be a supplier of diverse, or supporter, I should say, of diverse independent researchers to develop performance measurement methods and put those methods in the public domain where they can be critiqued by researchers, providers, purchasers, consumers. We want the data and we want the methods. But it's fine if the government wants to do its own reports on provider performance, even in the face of provider resistance. But we worry that such reporting will be too cautious to give consumers simple information that will make it easy to choose providers that will best meet their personal needs and preferences. Difficulty of consumer use of the Hospital Compare website, the real lack of development and information in the Physician Compare website give one quite a bit of reason for pessimism on the government doing the reporting. And you contrast that to the creativity of ProPublica, which finds a way to put these data in a form that consumers can actually use and to be responsive, a different response to you than to you, and to be able to find the data. All that stuff, I think, really private entities probably can do a better job of than CMS can do. So what measures need more emphasis and what data is needed to support them? For a little disruptive perspective, let me share with you what we have seen from consumers. We watched the use of our Consumers Checkbook website. Of all the many types of service providers we evaluate, the ratings consumers look at most often are ratings of doctors. So, you know, I've read in reports people say, well, people don't care. You know, they don't look at, you know, quality ratings of doctors. Well, maybe they don't look at them, but they look at them more than they, twice as much as they look at ratings of plumbers and auto repair shops. And interestingly, about 13 times as much as they look at ratings of hospitals. So that's kind of an interesting perspective. We've also done tests of consumer interest in different measures of doctor quality. And by far, the greatest interest was in consumer survey ratings of doctors and in results of surveys of doctors asking for their recommendations of other doctors for care of a loved one. Both of these types of measures were chosen at least three times by at least three times as many website users as ratings based on board certification and training, or as ratings based on whether a doctor follows nationally defined evidence-based medical guidelines for quality and efficiency of care, the HEDIS type measures. So where consumers are starting from may be different from what some of us might have expected. So now here are a few thoughts on possible measures for future expansion. And I'm not going to limit myself. I don't seem to be limiting myself word-wise in general, but I'm not going to limit myself on to talking about these large data sets, but just sort of try to think about anything that consumers might possibly find useful. So I think one measure is to expand on is whether doctors effectively use electronic medical records. Since such information can be collected via the Meaningful Use Program as to this doctor use of these things, and its importance needs to be forcefully explained to consumers that this really will matter to you or could matter to you. Another opportunity might be to explore with specialty boards whether they can let doctors voluntarily identify themselves as performing, let's say, in the top quarter of other doctors in their on certain dimensions of the certification process. That's something I've never seen done, but it seems to me it would be interesting, particularly because it might actually reveal something about doctors' diagnostic skills. And one of the problems, I think, is that almost all of our measures out there, process measures, outcome measures even, don't really get to the question of diagnostic skills, which are so critical to having a good physician. Another opportunity would be to more measures of clinical bad outcomes. In analysis we've done, we've seen at the physician level statistically significant differences in surgical death rates, complication rates, readmission rates. This kind of information needs to be public. And if we had better data, measures might be possible to assess whether a doctor's is prescribing too many of some kinds of procedures identified in the Choosing Wisely initiative. A very important challenge is to report on patient-reported health status and outcomes, possibly using PROMIS, SF, and other similar types of measures. Calculating some of these types of measures requires assembling better databases, of course. There's a continuing need to push for all-payer databases where it will be understood that the data can be used for provider quality measurement. So, you know, we're talking about large national databases like that. That's a great thing. As an all-payer database, I should say. But participation in registries is important. If the registry rules allow the data to be used for public reporting on provider performance, registries can collect information that goes well beyond what you're going to find in claims data. It makes sense to find out, I think, whether publicly reporting which physicians participate in appropriate registries and explaining why participation matters could actually put pressure on doctors and providers in general to choose to participate. But the big opportunity is in health information exchange for performance measurement and various other reasons. That's it can be the heart of a lot of stuff. So that means we need to push for continuing expansion and standardization of information in electronic health records, including patient-reported information, and push providers to share this information in large regional and national databases. A public measure telling which providers are participating in these exchanges might actually create incentives. Certainly such participation could be a critical component in any future meaningful use programming, and the government needs to invest heavily in this path. Think of it as the interstate highway system for healthcare. It's a major investment, and it just it really should be a focus. Finally, I'll focus finish on a relatively easy and quick but strangely neglected path: getting a nationwide database of patient experience survey results on individual doctors, a database which would also be able to be aggregated to the practice site and group level, but starting with the individual level doctor. Why the government has not pushed forward with this is baffling to me. We have a good instrument in ARC's CGCAPS survey. This survey and possible variants give good information on how well doctors listen, explain things, keep track of the patient's history, coordinate care, engage the patient in shared decision-making. This is important stuff. If a doctor doesn't listen, for example, the doctor can't do a good diagnosis or come up with treatment plans that fit the patient. If the doctor doesn't explain things well, then patients won't know or be motivated to do their part in care. As one article in the Journal of American Medical Association put it, in a diverse set of studies, effective communication has been linked with better adherence to treatment plans, more appropriate medical decisions, and better outcomes. And measurement should be at the individual physician level. Dana Safran and others in the Journal of the of General Internal Medicine showed that the individual physician, not the practice, nor the group, nor the plan, accounts for a majority of the variance in the communication aspect of patient experience. So why don't we have survey results at the individual physician level? The explanation we hear is that it's too expensive. To prove this wrong, a Consumer's Checkbook did a demonstration in four metropolitan areas in collaboration with United. Thank you, Lou. Aetna, Cigna, and local Blues plans. We did a rigorous survey and published results at the individual physician level showing a large number of significant differences among physicians. The demonstration showed that this could all be done at a cost of about $120 per physician and still show these really meaningful results. This is much less than Berenson et al. Have demonstrated it costs physicians to report PQRS-type data. And that $120 can be cut to about $60 or $40 per year, since it's not necessary to do the survey more than once every 2 or 3 years, although physicians can be enabled to do the survey more often if they choose. So this is a big immediate opportunity and one that the federal government could easily make happen with a little support and both financial support and encouragement. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Robert. That's a rich list of a wish list of very interesting things. Robert.
So Communicatalyst is a national consumer organization focused on giving voice to consumers, particularly low-income consumers. We have historically been fighting to open up the black box and been supportive of Robert and Consumers Union and ProPublica's work. I think it's important to look at consumers from two perspectives. One is the role of a user and payer, and other in terms of their public policy role. You know, with the trend towards cost sharing and health plans, it's become more important for consumers to be good purchasers. And with the implementation of the ACA, millions of people are looking at the exchanges, the marketplaces, to choose health plans. So I think we've had a lot of experience with that. And frankly, I think they're still either not looking at that black box or they're looking at it through the Lucite lens because there's a lot of problems. Consumer and payers even find the most basic information elusive. The Urban Institute recently came out with a report that it's difficult to get information from many marketplaces about websites, the marketplace websites, about whether a health plan is tiered, what providers are in the network, and what are the cost-sharing differences associated with those tiers. For the low-income consumers, who most of the people going are low-income consumers, quality data is complex and very difficult to understand. It's clear that one size doesn't fit all. Information needs of a 60-year-old dually eligible is very different from the information needs of someone coming to checkbook. So in terms of what we're talking about today, I think we need to start with getting the basics right. We need better information about who and what's in a network and what are the costs to consumers. Charlie mentioned the importance of accuracy. The data needs to be made more understandable for consumers, taking into account the wide range of differences. Community Catalyst has been supporting an effort to develop a single composite quality measure that could be broken down into component parts, focusing on the particular needs of consumers. We agree with Robert in terms of patient-reported information. We see collecting patient activation as a quality measure and a focus on outcome. And finally, in terms of consumers, they need help doing this. The average person is not going to be able to make the kind of cost-quality equations that we need in terms of coming up with values without support. Medicare beneficiaries get this sort of assistance through the state assistance programs. We have a consumer assistance program as part of people focusing on enrollment. We need to sort of think about expanding that program. So in terms of consumers in terms of public policy, there's important pieces to really think about. Community Catalyst was one of the first organizations to push for transparency around the conflicts of interest of pharmaceutical companies and physicians. It was actually the courts that opened that data up. Charlie and ProPublica took that database and made it into a very effective tool for looking at what is the relationship of the pharmaceutical industry to the physicians. That perhaps hasn't helped in terms of allowing the individual consumers to make choices about either their drugs or their providers, but it's had a significant impact on medical schools and hospitals. It's, from a public policy standpoint, it has made a really important change. The other area that we have been working on is around hospitals and community benefits. Hospitals want to keep what their community benefits are often a mystery, and the value of those community benefits a mystery to consumers. Community organizations want and need to have that information. We've been working hard to get a database of information around Schedule H, which provides some of that hospital community benefit data with George Washington University. So we're looking to move forward in improving that kind of data for consumers. Consumers need to understand on the basics of healthcare the idea of sort of some of the broader trends in healthcare are a black box to consumers. And the government and consumer organizations need to push hard for opening up that black box.
Thank you, Robert.
Hi, so I'm from Consumer Reports, and I direct the Consumer Reports Health Rating Center. And while we're an ardent user of all the data we've been talking about today, our role is really into trying to translate that data for consumers and to try to put it in context and raise awareness of the problems of that data bring to light. So that's really what we focus on. And so it's really about having people use the data, not just having the data available. And by using it, though, we are able to identify, you know, some of the strengths and weaknesses of that data. So at the Rating Center, where we work, we're a group of scientists and doctors and consumers and writers who take data from various sources, and much of it is the government, and translate that for consumers. And we look at the areas of drugs, preventive services like cancer screenings. We also work in the area of hospital quality, physician quality, and also health plan quality. So we've been doing this for about 10 years, and we reach about 20 million consumers per month, and even more through our partners, so not just through our own media products like Consumer Reports Magazine or online, but also through partners that can reach other audiences. Now, you're probably familiar with our work in the area of cars and electronics, and we often compete with those areas, and we make fun of each other, and I'd rather be testing cars than testing hospitals, and we can't bring hospitals into the labs and all that, but it's a healthy rivalry. But I was just looking up some data the other day, and I was really excited to see that in our own measurement of how our readers use data and how use and understand these stories, that our stories on healthcare costs and quality, whether it's about physicians or about hospitals or about drugs, sometimes supersede or rank higher than stories about cars and electronics and washers. So it's really at top of mind for consumers, these areas of cost and quality. And consumers can understand it and use the information. So that's another common question I get asked is, well, you know, there's all this data out there, consumers can't really use it. But consumers can use it, and they do use it. And we hear from them about it, and we hear from them about the changes that they've made either in the hospital that they've chosen or the drugs that they take, or importantly, the discussions they have with their providers. So a lot of our editorial content drives people to have discussions with their physician or with their nurse practitioner about the drugs or about the hospital. So it's important to reinforce that relationship. So the thing is, we really appreciate what CMS has done in releasing data, and we use it, so we advocate to continue that release of data. The important thing, though, that I see that's sort of been skipped over is the issue of safety and errors, because that's one area that's really hard to measure. And we seem to have jumped from sort of process measures and readmissions and things like that all the way to patient-reported measures, like whether you can climb stairs, but skip the really difficult task of measuring patient safety and measuring errors. And we've actually asked consumers in our own surveys about this, and about in our last survey, about 30% of people self-reported they experienced one or more errors in the hospital. And that's probably a huge underestimate, because that's just what the patient noticed themselves, not so much what maybe went unnoticed to them. So I really feel like that not only in the area of data collection, but also in the area of how we measure safety and errors, that this is a really important thing for us to focus on. Another way to get at this issue is through registry data. So registry data is probably the most powerful data that's out there. You've heard a little bit about it in this panel. And I think that's an area where we'd like to push more to get that data available to the public. We've been able to be successful in a small area of heart surgery. We've worked with heart surgeons that have voluntarily released their data to the public. We have hospitals and doctors that are really high-performing and even ones that are low-performing that have agreed to release their data. And I think this is the most powerful decision tool that consumers can use, because they can look at a procedure that they may be undergoing, like heart valve replacement or heart bypass surgery, and find those hospitals and physicians that perform the highest in these ratings of quality. And those quality measures look both at outcomes and also at complications in a reliable way. So that's what we would ask that we sort of make more public. And I think CMS, with the power that they have to require these sorts of quality reporting systems, that they start making that more of a requirement in terms of being reimbursed by CMS. And then some sort of more tangential requests I'd have is to not try to reinvent the wheel. I think Bob Krugoff brought this up, that CMS is sort of required to do public reporting as well. And it kind of makes a lot of confusion at the level of the consumer, because those websites that are out there now that the government puts out, Hospital Compare and things like that, are very difficult for consumers to understand. And so I would suggest they focus more on the data and the quality of the data and requirements for reporting the data rather than the consumer side of things. And then the final thing, which is kind of a little geeky, is that I would ask CMS not to forget about infrastructure, because those of us who use the data have to deal with the structure of the data, the missing elements in the data that make it hard to release accurate and timely reports to the public. So thank you.
Well, we've heard a lot about choosing doctors. We've heard some about choosing health plans. I'd like to ask each of you to say a word about how you would hope the feedback to the providers themselves and to the health plans would improve the situation over time, because isn't that ultimately what we hope consumers having better information will accomplish? Any thoughts on that?
Well, we've watched this with patient experience data most carefully and tried to work with some of the specialty societies and stuff to figure to tell doctors how they can improve and where they can find resources to improve. I must say, I don't think we've been particularly successful in that, but I think that's probably because we're not very good at it. We tend to be a measurement organization, not a quality improvement organization. But there, you know, there ought to be potential there. However, I don't think, and yes, that is one of the objectives. But I also think that one of the objectives is helping consumers find the good ones, and that also gets you good care. I mean, there are two paths that one can go down here.
Yeah, I think that when you look, for example, the pharmaceutical data, I think that you have the professional societies stepping up and understanding that there are implications to the conflicts of interest in trying to address those through changing policies within the societies, within medical schools, and within academic medical centers. You know, I think there is necessary to have a partnership here. I don't think the market's going to move us to away from all providers who are quote unquote poor quality of care. That's not going to happen. So we're going to need to rely on a partnership between hospitals, doctors, consumers to really get it right.
You know, I have to say, in our public reporting of hospital quality data, we really do see a real big response by hospitals. First, they get angry, of course, because they don't like to be rated. But then they tell us that they're focusing on the things that we're reporting on. So the more we report on things we want to change, the more they're going to pay attention to those things. That came in the form of a complaint. How come you're doing this? My physicians are focusing on what you're reporting on instead of what I want them to do. So I saw that as a successful. I was like, thank you. They did my job. Now I can go home for the day. So that's one area we see changes in. We also see areas where hospitals will call us and say, thank you. Thank you, we didn't know X, Y, Z. Now we're going to look more into it and try to understand why that's a problem. So those are the kind of calls I really like to get, because I know that the people there really care about it. And then we also hear from hospitals about patients canceling procedures and surgeries and them losing revenue. So there is some market change going on. It may not be as much as we'd like right now, but there's something happening.
Both Doris and Robert Krugoff talked about getting the raw data out there, and you were quite vociferous about how government should just get the raw data out there. But there are risks in putting out raw data that risk of misinterpretation, as we saw in this data release that triggered this event.
Well, I think there is some risk, and there will always be some risk that the data will just be wrong, you know, the way CMS has it in the first place,
or it'll be misinterpreted.
Or it will be misinterpreted. You know, I'm always troubled by that response. We've had a lot of experience. We have a health plan comparison tool that we've tried to put out. We put out in the Illinois Exchange, for instance, and we asked the federal government, can we have the benefit, the description of benefits, the co-payments, you know, co-insurance, et cetera, for each of these plans, so we can do an actuarial estimate of out-of-pocket costs for each plan, you know, the best estimate for somebody like you with your health status, et cetera. So you can really make this comparison in a coherent way that most people don't have a chance of doing. And the government, unlike the part of CMS we're talking about here, the government said, no, we can't. We're not going to give you those data. And then they finally said, well, we'll give you the data the day before open enrollment starts. Well, you know, these actuarial estimates take, you know, many weeks and very complicated calculations to do. We get it the day before open enrolement. So, but the reason, there were two reasons. One is the plans wouldn't like it. And the other is that we might put out something that's confusing, you know, or that is wrong. You know, I believe in the marketplace of ideas, that you put out something that's confusing is wrong and nobody listens to you again and somebody sues you. I like that way of having the world work. And we take some chances on that front as opposed to not giving the information out.
Lest we get too focused on the government not releasing, big companies don't like it very much either.
Right, right.
I think it's time for audience questions. And we have possible microphones. There's one right question back here.
Hi, I'm Lauren Hershey. I was actually a guest scholar here under Alice about the breakup of AT&T about 28 years ago. So, hi, Alice. I follow medicine a little more closely given my aging process, and I'm curious to learn over the last couple of years, Mayo Clinic book, Cleveland Clinic book, there is something called wellness medicine that is happening. I don't know how to define it. There's allopathic medicine. I never thought in those terms till I read it a couple of years ago. That's healthcare delivery. So my curiosity is to ask each of you three panelists, how do you evaluate what's happening? How do you measure it? And how do you describe it? Has this wellness movement been around for 2 years or 6 years or 9 years? I don't want to establish, I don't want to connect it to some personalities on TV. I want to connect it to University of Michigan, where I've read about it, or Yale University. But the question is data. So if I move 10,000 steps a day, big deal, but it's supposed to make me healthier, how do you measure that? You get my point.
I think I understand what you're trying to say. I mean, that movement's been around for a long time. If you just look at the products we rate, we rate diets and exercise, and so you've got that aspect of quote-unquote wellness. I think we take it in the form of the preventive services. I think that's one of the areas that we focus on in terms of helping people understand what preventive services that can keep them healthier. I'm not sure if that's along the line of what you're thinking of, but that's our focus. That's the aim that we take.
Yeah, I guess I see that there's a trend towards payment reform that would move hospitals and payers in the direction of treating a person more holistically. You know, it certainly has been around for a long time, but I think it's getting much more traction now.
But some of it's not medical.
Right, exactly.
So much of it is not. It's nutrition, it's exercise.
Right, exactly.
Are there evolving systems for evaluating that from the point of view of the consumer?
Well, if you think about the dual demonstration projects, there are evaluations going on now of that, and that's really looking to take the Medicare and Medicaid payment, combining it and keeping people out of hospital and out of nursing homes and theoretically healthier. You know, that's something that I think the Research Triangle is doing right now.
I think there's I think the visibility of patient self-help and non-allopathic medicine it has increased over time with TV and every place else and a lot of newsletters and things like that. So I do think there's progress, and I do think that many of the health plans are looking for alternative ways to help their members, hoping that these will solve problems and reduce the health plans costs. And some of these providers, I mean, for instance, Checkbook does evaluations of acupuncturists. That's more a straight-up sort of thing than some things where you don't really know whether the person's hitting the bottom of your foot right or something like that. Some are much harder than others to do, but at least some of those things you can get some meaningful feedback on the quality of those providers, or at least on the ability of the providers to explain things and or to give miracle cures. I've had a miracle cure by an acupuncturist. So after having many times one time I went to the acupuncturist's office and he said, now you have to listen for the che and all this kind of stuff. And then he put a lamp on my leg and put on music and let me sleep for a half hour. Or, I wasn't supposed to be sleeping, but I was. And he said, well, how did that work for you? I said, it was terrific. And then but when he had been talking to me, I was just thinking, the warm lamp and sleep, how can you beat that? I've been thinking, did I lock my bike out front? So I don't know. People have very different views on how this stuff works.
You gave an anecdotal report.
Yeah.
How do you get the
Well, I think we haven't done much in general. That has not been as – it's a bigger and bigger part of the system and the economy, and I don't see it as having the same level of visibility and measurability that we're trying to see in the regular medical care system.
Other questions?
I have a question that comes from Twitter. This is from Atreus Health. Is there any information about increasing consumer engagement through transparent cost and quality data, and how can we increase engagement?
I can speak anecdotally. Just from our organization, we definitely see an increase in engagement from consumers in both the data that we're providing out there and also with the stories and consumers telling their stories to us. I think what can make it more useful is just making the data more accessible, more personalizable, all the things that we heard today, and making it more about their day-to-day decisions or their decisions they're making about procedures that they have enough time to make those decisions about, such as maternity, childbirth, knee replacement, things like that.
Yeah, I think that's there's been a lot of literature about why consumers get involved or not involved in cost and quality data. I think for low-income consumers, it is somewhat different, and you need to think about, you know, how to engage folks who have historically maybe been uninsured. You know, that's where we think consumer assistance is important. The Medicare program has assistance in people choosing plans. We think that's sort of something that would really help.
Yes.
Thank you, David Benowitz. I know there are some providers and organizations that are in the business specifically to help people, and there are others that are in the business to make money. And I'm just wondering, from your analyses, can you differentiate one from the other?
And start.
Well, I don't think we can get to the heart of their motivation, but I think we can look at their performance, and we can see, are they in fact making people better, and are they keeping costs reasonable? Are they overprescribing? You know, so I do think it's possible. Although even some of those things I talked about, this choosing wisely type, assessment, which is obviously a very important thing. And we don't know how to do that. And we're going to need better data to really decide, start rating, identifying providers who are really abusing as opposed to just getting a whole lot of referrals of somebody who actually needs that treatment.
Before we wind up, let me ask each of you very quickly, if you look ahead 10 years, what would you like to see in this world of consumer information about healthcare and consumer choice? What are the most important things that you think the world ought to look like 10 years from now in this dimension? Start with Doris.
I'll go back to where I was before about safety and medical errors. I feel like we've been trying to crack that nut for at least 10 years, if not more. So if in 10 years we were able to have a way for consumers to understand their risk of medical errors in any particular hospital or within any particular surgeon, that would be where I would want to be.
And there are fewer risky providers, one would assume.
I think we need to consolidate information, make it easier for the consumer to use. I think we need to focus more on outcomes and the patient experience.
I would agree that we have to push toward measuring outcomes. You know, different people are in very different situations. Somebody who has no chronic condition and who has no acute condition is not much interested in outcomes, except they want to avoid having something go wrong. Somebody who has a serious chronic condition really is looking at measures that are very clinically oriented, et cetera. And so those things have to be tailored, as you say, to the measures have to be tailored to the patients or to the consumers.
Given the demographics, more and more people will have
the latter, right?
Thank you very much, all of you. This has been a very good panel, and I hope that some of these things come to pass quite soon. Let me turn it back to, a round of applause for the panel.
I guess that's better than coming last, right? You actually...
And then let me turn it back to Kavita for some final remarks.
All right. Thank you, Alice. And go ahead and stay, because this won't take very long. I just wanted to thank all our panelists again and also thank our excellent staff at Brookings, Rio Hart, Monica Madej, Caitlin Brandt, Domitia Masi, Joanna Klatzman, and a number of people who helped make sure that everybody was as comfortable as possible, and also for the folks watching on the web. I just want to highlight a couple of things. I mentioned some of the work we're already doing with this data set and data releases. We're going to have several more briefs that talk about topics covered today, and I wanted to be a little provocative in what might be coming after today's conversation. We've talked about kind of uses that are not just consumer-centric, but what happens if some of this data could be used to create some of these high-value networks that we're seeing in the private marketplace, as well as on these health insurance exchanges. And what if we could actually, as Chapin alluded to, get researchers together and almost do kind of a crowdsourcing of valuable research cases or findings, things that we all find interesting that we don't necessarily have one entity taking lead responsibility for, but that we could work with nonprofits, research organizations, as well as consumers on what they find interesting and try to put that together in a way that's not contingent on what the government would do. And then finally, I think Doris kind of talked about a conversation that's been missing around safety and errors. It wasn't that long ago that we had Crossing the Quality Chasm and some of the work of Don Berwick and other colleagues who highlighted these problems. And lest we be remiss to think that we've solved all of them, how can we be pointing towards places to improve and think about concentrating efforts from transparency and data to show people not just what's bad, but what we can do to improve the infrastructure of healthcare in our country. So I did want to point that the conversation won't end today. We are going to be doing future publications, as well as hopefully extending this in other ways. So thank you for your time and attention, and have a great rest of the afternoon. Take care.